Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. I am your host, Bill Sickens. Bill Gretchen, welcome, welcome.
Hello. Hello there.
So, we have a date coming up in October. And this is the date that Windows 10 ceases to be current and becomes obsolete, at least according to Microsoft. We're going to be talking about this a little bit later in this segment as to what you can do to try to keep yourself secure and some things you must do if you're going to continue running Windows 10. Bill, Gretchen, are you guys, I know Gretchen, you still have one machine on 10, and Bill, do you?
Yeah, I have one machine on 10.
Okay. And Gretchen, I know we're going to upgrade yours. Bill, are you going to keep yours?
Oh, I'm going to upgrade it as if I can. I just haven't had the time.
Understood. Yeah, and that's the case with a lot of people. So there are some out there that can't, hardware requirements being one. We're going to talk a little bit about that, and there's other reasons. So there are a few things that need to be done. I was just curious because for the first time this month, the deployment of Windows 11 has exceeded that of Windows 10 in the United States. So it is starting to gain some traction, you know. All right, so we'll go ahead and circle back to that in a little bit, but let's go ahead and jump in on the news first thing here. What do we have?
All right, FBI confirms iPhone and Android warning. Delete all these texts. So what does that mean?
Well, they're having attacks on both the iPhone and Android platforms, and this is done through text messaging, and it surged more than 700% this last month.
Jeez.
And that is where the problem is coming from with this. Not that it wasn't a problem before that, but it's something that is really being in that. And what's going on is basically you'll get a text message that says something to the effect of your driver's license is about to expire. Click this link to make an appointment at the DMV. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Or confirm your doctor's appointment or other things like that. You have a package arriving. That's another big one. And we need to confirm your address. And then you click on these links and the idea is you get to a very real looking website now and you fill in personal information, let's say the package one. So can you please confirm your address? And it has an erroneous address. So you put in your address, right? That kind of thing. And what's happening with these is twofold on that. First of all, when you click through, there is a number or a token or something hidden in the link in the text message. It tells the bad guys your phone number is a real phone number. Okay. And the second thing is if you disclose personal information through this process, they now have your phone number and your personal information.
And
know that it's valid. So this is being investigated. This is really coming up in Tennessee with a DMV scan, kind of what we just talked about in the beginning of it. But when you do this, getting your personal information out there is part of it. The other thing is that when you click links, it can sometimes put malware on your phone and that type of a thing. One that I saw that's not related directly to this warning, but is the same kind of thing, was one that was dealing with Amazon a while back where you would click through the link and it would come up, hey, install our Amazon app and we'll give you $5 off your next order, which is something these companies do, right? So to that end, you install the app and now you're installing malware on your phone. So if you get these kind of texts in, if they're from somebody you don't know, if it seems off, just delete them. The other thing is don't reply with stop, because that also confirms that your phone number is a valid phone number. And on most modern phones, you have the ability to block the number. So if you want to do that, you can go in and do that. It's a little different procedure on Android or iPhone, but usually pretty simple. And it is related around when you go to delete the message, it will usually ask you if you want to block the number or not. And reported as spam. And if that's being asked by your phone, it's fine to report it as spam. But yeah, don't go through and click the link. Most of these seem to be coming from cybercriminal syndicates in China. And it is very difficult to block just because the internet is so open.
Experts issue warning about unsubscribe links that could get you hacked.
Yeah, so this is along with our previous topic. And this is another thing that's a bit of a problem, not just on text messages, but emails and everything else. It used to be that you get an ad, you don't want the ad at the very bottom in little itty bitty letters, usually is the word unsubscribe. And if you click on the unsubscribe link, it's supposed to take your name off of the whatever list was getting you that email. Well, the bad guys have figured out the same thing like with the text messages. If you click unsubscribe and they have the hidden token in it, verifies here your email address usually is valid because it has a unique link for everyone that it went out to. And when you go in there, okay, well, you want to unsubscribe, you know, enter your name and email and whatever to unsubscribe. And now they're getting your personal information that way. The best thing to do, again, is just block these messages. And you can do that in your email, kind of like you do with your phone. Put them on a spam list, and that way it doesn't come in. But the idea here for both of these things is you don't want to interact with the bad guys. The cyber criminals are expecting you to do that, and they're very good at getting information out of you, even if you are privy and on top of these things. So the best way is, like they always say, the best way to survive a knife fight is don't be there. The best way to survive these type of things is don't respond to anything in there. Don't be there. Just block it, delete it, and move on.
Massive solar storm sparks rare G4 alert. What it means for Earth. What does it mean?
So I have decided that all these solar storms are a conspiracy.
Ah.
I don't think any of this is real. I think it's the idea of getting me out at 3 o'clock in the morning to try to see the northern lights. And of course, they're not there. There are lights to the north, but they're street lights on the next city over, not. But in all seriousness, yes, we are having another solar storm. We're in the solar maximum with our sun right now, which means that it is the most active part of its 11-year cycle. And what happens with this is it's throwing out radiation and other things. This is what causes the northern lights. You see them up in the northern areas a lot more because of the magnetic field of the Earth. But they come down south everywhere except where I am, apparently. And from that side of it, it's pretty to look at. But this plays havoc with electronics. It's actually causing, they've been having problems with some of the Starlink satellites falling out of the sky and other things like that. It causes problems with communication. I know back in my dad's day, he was a ham radio operator. And when these things would happen, it would cause problems being able to use the ham radio. So it is an Earth-wide warning. This is very rare for him to do this. But they're saying that this could be one of the biggest ones we've had in a long time. And usually this doesn't like destroy your electronics, but it is a good idea to keep anything, especially anything that's really, you know, could easily be messed up inside. So, you know,
I have a scary question. Can I ask it?
Of course you can ask it.
What about your airplane that's cruising along using all that equipment? Could it mess up the airplane?
Could it? Yes. Now, in the commercial aviation, though, they've taken a lot of steps to be able to secure themselves, you know, so that they don't have these kind of problems. But what it can do with planes and cars, for that matter, too, is it can scramble the GPS signals. So if you're automatically flying your plane like on autopilot or that kind of a thing, and I would imagine with the autonomous vehicles, they have similar problems. It could start getting bad information on where it's going. So that could definitely be a problem. But at least on a plane, on any that I plan to be a passenger on, at least anytime in the future, you have a pilot that is going to know that this is a problem and can act for it and be able to take it from there. I don't see it knocking out electrical systems on a plane or causing any kind of damage because, again, they have taken steps because they know that this happens to secure things and isolate things and, you know, do that in such a way to where it will at the very least be minimized, but hopefully not get damaged at all.
AI disagrees on locations, causing confusion.
So AIs do what's called hallucinating every so often. We've talked about this in the past, you know, and basically what's happening here is this, this same type of thing. And where we're seeing this is AIs are being more and more used as fact-checking tools for social media and regular media and that kind of thing. And where they're having problems with this is where the chatbot will look at it and decide that the location of something is in one place, and the second one will look at it in the other and say it's somewhere else. And then you have a conflict. And then because a lot of the institutions, let's just say, that are using solely AI don't check these things, or at least do it right, it goes out with erroneous information. So some examples of this during the Los Angeles unrest that happened recently and things from the military parade and some other stuff that's been in the news is it will say that it's from a completely incorrect or wrong location. So it's a picture of Los Angeles of people protesting, and it's tagged that it came from Florida or something, you know, that kind of a thing. So again, AI is an amazing thing, but it is something that, like a lot of our other technology, is augmentation, not really something that should be replacing the human component of all of this. And just a little bit of an aside here is completely random, is our backup cameras, because this is a question that keeps coming in too. Backup cameras are designed to make it safer to back up in your car so you can see what's behind you. That doesn't mean don't look in your mirrors and do the normal stuff that you would do outside of that. Again, an idea of augmentation of technology that's not designed to replace common sense. Unfortunately, you know, I could go on with that for more time than we have in this segment.
I can imagine. Okay. Snapchat adds new features for creators, including an easier way to edit videos.
So they're launching a timeline editor, is what they're calling it. A new way to create videos set from saved memories, the ability to auto-save stories to profiles, and on and on. And it's really interesting to me that on sites like Snapchat, YouTube, Facebook, anyone that uses videos, it's actually gotten to a point now where the video editing in the website is actually better than what I think video editing software did even 2 years ago. It's faster, it's easier to use. And the other thing that's kind of cool about all this too is this, let's say you're uploading a video to Facebook for a post that you're doing and you use their video editor. Well, it's going to post something that's specifically designed to work with, in this case, Facebook properly. So it fits, it's formatted, all that kind of thing. And at the end of the day, it makes it a lot easier to deal with. You even can edit videos on your phone now and those kind of things. So again, at the end of the day, they're just taking this and stepping it into modern world that a lot of other social sites are already doing. But to me, it's just kind of interesting that that's even an option, because again, not so long ago, editing a video not only wouldn't be done through the web, but it would require, you know, a very high-end computer and a software and all kinds of expensive things. Or before that, and I'm going to age myself a little bit, you did it on analog tape decks where you were copying from one to another to edit, you know. It's just goes to show how much the technology has changed. The one cool thing about all of this is it does bring what at one time was only available to people that could afford it, or professionals in the media, you know, that kind of thing. The ability for pretty much anybody to do things that are high quality and look good. And it does give a little bit more access. So just my opinion on it. But yeah. So as promised, we're going to talk about Windows 10 today. And October 14th of this year, Microsoft will officially stop supporting Windows 10. And for a lot of us that have been able to move over to Windows 11, especially since Windows 11 works a lot better than it did when it first came out now, it's not really a problem. Yeah, Gretchen, I know you were having some fun with that, weren't you?
It was really irritating at first. It was on my mom's computer, and so I would help her out with her stuff, and it was Windows 11, and then I would go back and use my Windows 10.
Right.
And but as time has gone on, it seems that they got rid of some of the weird, irritating quirks.
Yeah. I have to say, actually, I'm kind of impressed with how far they've gotten with this. It is now that, you know, Windows 11 is easier to use. There are some things that are a little bit different, but once you get over the learning curve, it's pretty good. It isn't a problem where stuff doesn't work, which was the case in the beginning, you know. But that being said, there are a number of reasons why one might not move to Windows 11. One of them is the equipment that you're running on. And initially, this was a much bigger deal because there was a lot of existing computers and other things that Microsoft had deemed unnew enough. There's our word of the day, unnew enough. They had deemed this equipment to where arbitrarily it wouldn't run the new version of Windows. Now, recently, I want to say about 6 months ago or so, Microsoft revisited these requirements. So if you did the checker and you were told that your system couldn't be updated, it's a good idea to run it again because you might be fine now. But let's say that for whatever reason, you still can't upgrade, or you shouldn't upgrade, or don't want to, or there's some reason that you're not going to. And there's a lot of things that would qualify for that. So you're still going to be running Windows 10 after October 14th. Well, what does this mean to you? It does not mean that a black hole is going to open up and swallow your computer. It will continue to work. But as you move away from that date, it will become less and less secure because there's no longer going to be updates. Mm-hmm. And with a lot of the zero-day exploits and things that have been going on, especially this year, that is something that could very quickly lead to a number of problems. So how can you protect yourself? There is actually a way that you can do this if you want to. It's going to cost some money, but it's to subscribe to something from Microsoft called Extended Security Updates. This is a way to be able to continue to keep it secure, but you don't get updates for like functionality or any of that type of thing. It is simply the security updates. So on a personal home computer, how much does this cost? A one-year subscription is $30. Businesses cost more, starting at $61 per device. And then the other thing about this to know is that these prices do go up subsequent years, with the last year you'd be able to do this, I believe, being 2028. So if you need to stay on Windows 10, $30, I think it's very much worth it to make sure that your device remains secure. And then hopefully that'll give you a little bit more time to either be able to move to new hardware or make the changes that you would need to make to be able to continue from 10 to 11. Now, fortunately, this is not like upgrading from Windows 7 to 8, you know, where one was great and the other one was just awful. So we don't have that anymore, which is another thing. If you tried Windows 11, Gretchen, like you were saying, when it first came out and didn't have a good experience, take a look at it again, because it will be better.
Yeah, it is.
They fixed a lot
I have a printer that is no longer workable because of the change. So that was disappointing. It was a good machine.
And these are some of the things to think about. Now, the printer you're talking about, that's the LaserJet 4, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is an older printer. There's no question about it.
Oh, it's a very old printer, but it's a workhorse. It was great.
So looking up and being a little bit creative, sometimes you can get around these problems. One of the big things is drivers. If the drivers aren't available, you're going to have trouble. Now, with something like the LaserJet 4, you actually can get an old piece of hardware. You'd have to find it on eBay, called a Jet Direct card. And they plug into the back of the printer and it gives you an Ethernet port. And then you would take that and either plug it into your network or plug it into, you know, like a bridge or a Wi-Fi adapter of some kind. And that would actually allow it to still work. And that's just one example of a lot of the older equipment. You can sometimes do things to keep it going, but a lot of times you can't. And peripherals are a big deal because they're expensive, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Now, one thing, if you're going to continue to run Windows 10 after the October 14th date, there's another thing that you must do prior, and that is going and downloading the installation media. So Microsoft has a media installation tool, which is how you set up your computer these days. It's not sent out on, you know, DVDs or anything like it was in the past. So you go to their website and you download the tool. And then what it does is it creates a flash drive that allows you to reinstall Windows. Now, I think very likely that as soon as this date hits, they're going to no longer offer that for Windows 10. So you want to go do this so that you have a backup, a way to reinstall Windows 10 should you need to, from a legitimate source. And I know in the past when this has happened with software, if you were to just Google, you know, my piece of software I need an installation for, oh, you're going to get a lot of hits of places that you can go to download it. There's a lot of them out there. However, you probably don't want to trust any of them. So getting this set up beforehand and having it in place where if you did need to reload or that type of a thing, you would be able to do it. It's definitely something that's due. This doesn't cost anything. And the license that you already have for Windows 10 will allow you to reinstall, but is definitely something that you want to do. And then the other thing, just to circle back a little bit, Gretchen, you brought up with the printers, to check your peripherals, because, and software for that matter, because not only is it Windows that will no longer get security updates, which you're going to need to pay to get more, but the software that specifically works for it probably isn't going to get updated either. And that can be sometimes just as much of a problem as the operating system itself. So those are some of the things you want to do to get prepared for this. And again, just know that it's not going to shut down. And one of the biggest questions we have is, will the computer turn on Windows 10 after October 14th? Yes, it will. It'll boot right up like it does now. It just won't get updates anymore. So anyway, So that's where we're headed. Windows 11 is the only supported Windows operating system for home use that's going to be out there, which is also a little bit unusual, but is the case here. And from what I've been told, as much as they've done some updates and there's new technology, well, we aren't going to see the end of the blue screen of death yet. So I've been hearing rumors that there's some changes for that, although I don't completely know why. You would still need a crash screen, so who cares if they change the color, right?
Yeah, I think just leave it as it is. I mean, We understand what it is, and it's a moment to go, uh-oh, and you know, you need to call someone who knows what it's about.
Yeah. And even as many of us, including myself, will start swearing at things when this happens, actually getting that is a good thing because it prevents other damage from happening to your system when something happens where it can no longer run. So your software's gotten screwed up, something's happened, it blew screens, but your data's still okay. If they didn't have that in there, it could actually start corrupting things and all that kind of stuff. It's not fun.
Do you remember or did you ever see the cherry bomb that would go off on the Atari computer?
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and there was a cherry bomb. It's like, ah!
Yeah, you didn't want to see that any more than a blue screen. The other thing is the sad Mac icon on Macintosh, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, at the end of the day, you know, all that kind of stuff's there. I'm not even sure why we're talking about that, but it just seemed like
something. Well, and before that, you just had the line command stuff, It was syntax error. You know, what does that mean?
You know? Yeah, that was a long time ago. You're talking like BASIC and some of those things, you know,
Where you had the line command stuff, where you had to type everything in and to make stuff pop up.
Oh, man, I remember, what was Commodore load? What was it? I think it was .*.8. Yeah, it was something like that to load off of a floppy disk. And all of these things were definitely command line. I had an 8-bit Atari, and it was the same kind of thing. You know, you had to not only know how to do things, and there were no fail safes in those days. If the system got screwed up in some way, you could lose everything that you had, you know, on your floppy disk. And there you are. I don't know. I think with computers, things have gotten better. I don't miss floppy disks one bit. And I also don't miss modems. That was the other thing.
I don't miss modems either.
You know, it's nostalgia. I know there's a lot of people that do that. And in fact, one of the YouTube shows I watched, he actually bought an old switch from an office phone switching system that was capable of landline phones just so he could set up modems at his house between a server or a bulletin board computer, I guess, and his workstation just to have the experience. And yeah, that's fine and well, but not having the experience of floppy disks is something that I absolutely don't miss. And even on the old computers, they've come up with things now that will emulate the floppy drive, but it still takes an SD card or something to make it a lot better. And, you know, that kind of thing. But
my first experience with a modem was calling a friend. You called him on the phone and you're expecting to hear the phone ring and, you know, somebody answer. And this thing starts screeching at you. And it's like, what on earth is that? You know, that was the modem. He was running the modem. And there wasn't, and why he did that, you couldn't talk to him.
Yeah, and that's very true. I would tie up the phone line. So anyway, all right, Bill, you're doing a review in our next segment. And what are you reviewing?
Call of Cthulhu, The Sutra of Pale Leaves, Twin Suns Rising.
Okay, cool. So we've got that coming up. And we're also going to be talking to a guest about AI. And AI's role in social media, in this case, specifically LinkedIn. He's done a lot of research on that and is the expert in the area to give you some pointers on how to make that kind of a thing easier. And being myself that I'm not a huge social media person, anything I can do to make it easier is a good thing. This is User Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. Send us your questions. Send us your comments. We love to hear from you. Userfriendly.show is the one-stop place to be able to do that. Also to listen to back episodes, find out where we're streaming, check out Tech Wednesday, read the blog, and all of the other cool things that we have out there for you to do. So Userfriendly.show. All right, so our guest today is Al Kushner. He is an expert on growth strategy using AI with social media, specifically LinkedIn, has written a number of books on the subject and classes, and just is the general expert that I've ever talked to on this kind of thing. So let's go ahead and jump to the interview. Joining us now, guest Al Kushner, who is an author and does a lot of very interesting things with LinkedIn. Welcome to User Friendly.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
So before we begin on everything, let me give you an opportunity to give a little bit better background than I just did. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing on both fronts and where you're headed with things?
Well, I wrote the book on the LinkedIn Advantage. So I'm hoping to educate people about how to use AI and LinkedIn together to help streamline the process and make it much faster and easier to use so they can be more not afraid of using the platform, which a lot of people can get intimidated by, to say the least. So,
and that's true about LinkedIn. I've noticed that. You know, I think it's a little bit different. I like it. But I know there's a lot of people that are like, oh, I don't know, you know, what to do or how to do it or that type of a thing. So Interesting to talk about the idea of using AI with social marketing and social media and that kind of a thing. And, you know, it's involved in everywhere else. Obviously, this has been the big news of the last 2-3 years now. Tell us a little bit about what it means to work with LinkedIn or social media in general with AI versus a conventional way of doing it.
Well, what I like about AI is that it actually helps to create ideas for content that normally may take hours or days. Some people get writer's block, don't know what to say. So using AI technology will give you ideas of what to say. And if you use it strategically, you can post more frequently on LinkedIn, which is always going to be an advantage, as well as to create content for scripts, for videos, or for a whole host of other things. So it really gives you, it'll save you a lot of time and as well as efforts that normally you would do with conventional ways.
All right, so let's talk specifics about your book. Go ahead and give us a little background and synopsis on specifically what you were putting together and what it's for.
Well, it's for people who want to use AI technology, who want to use LinkedIn in a way that can help them make more quality connections. The idea, of course, is that by reading the book, you can become possibly a thought leader in your field and dominate the competition because of the resources that I have available. AI technology is changing in so many ways, and LinkedIn is very, very receptive to people who put content on LinkedIn that is of value. And if you do it the right way, if you be more of a giver than a taker, you'll find LinkedIn will be very much a great platform to make quality connections and to gain followers and to grow your business exponentially.
So what inspired you to create this book?
Well, I've looked at the books in the market that were talking about LinkedIn, and most of them didn't really address AI at all. So I said, well, there's an opportunity over here, and I jumped at it. I think it was great because the fact that LinkedIn is close to 1 billion users, I mean, this was huge as far as the opportunity to have the book reach so many people. And the fact that the AI technology is always changing and evolving, that it's just going to be the future. And I think that those who are looking to embrace it have a resource that they can use to help, whether it's creating content or scripts or video or a whole host of other things. To save you time, this will definitely be a good way to learn about how to do that so it doesn't become a time suck, as a lot of platforms do.
Now, have you actually sat down and done metrics on the difference between just using a platform like LinkedIn and then using it with your system and to see what the real difference is, time saving being one of them? But it would seem like you would get a lot more back, like you were saying earlier, from being able to set up partnerships and followers and all of that kind of thing.
Well, what I found to be is helping in creating videos. You know, videos on LinkedIn has become pretty much I guess it's pretty rare that people post videos, but now it's become more prevalent. I think that it's actually, the algorithm really loves videos on LinkedIn and will help to create more awareness once you post it on the site. So it really encourages you to do video as much as possible. A lot of people don't do it for a number of reasons. And a sweet spot for videos, I would say, is about 90 seconds long. So if you do that and post consistently at least 2 or 3 times a week, you'll certainly, I mean, I've seen a difference in terms of the amount of views that I've reached because of using videos compared to standard text. So that already was, for me, a game changer right there.
Now, is there a difference between posting a video directly to the platform and sharing ones, like, say, that you would already have posted on YouTube? Does that work the same way, or is posting it directly better?
posting directly is better. The algorithm definitely views it more native compared to sharing a link that goes outside of LinkedIn. They really frown against that. So if you have a video, even though it may take longer, better to upload it directly to LinkedIn as opposed to sharing a link outside.
Hey, that makes total sense. So how does somebody find your book?
Several. They can go to Amazon. It'll be available July 4th. And it's currently available in hardcover, so they can actually purchase directly. It's also available in audiobook. You can go to Spotify and be on the wait list for July 4th release for the audiobook, as well as ebook version. So also my website, linkvantage.com. There's a lot of great resources, including free ebooks, how to optimize your profile. So you can go there. Reach out to me on LinkedIn, another way to connect. So just off the top, a few options there.
That gives us a few different places to look. And I know you're giving us a QR code that will also help to narrow that down a little bit. So we get that shared out to everybody. Is there anything else you want to tell us?
Nothing that comes to mind other than the fact that if you're going to be posting on LinkedIn, you really need to, before you do any outreach, is to optimize your profile. Because the first thing people do is going to check out your profile. And if your picture is really not where it's at, you know, invest money, get a headshot, portrait professional. That would be the first thing to do. Take a look at your background image as well and see if you can update that. These things are essential for any type of outreach on there. A lot of times people don't even do that. You know, they leave their header blank in the background. The image is some car image they took, you know, with a camera. You really got to take the time because you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. And that really makes a difference. So before you do any outreach, optimize your profile. Look for keywords. Also include anything that you've done, any awards that you received, any volunteer work you have. There's always going to be looked upon more favorably than others who haven't done that. And most importantly is recommendations. Get as many recommendations as you can, you know, because that third-party endorsements are critical to any type of outreach. They want to know who's used your services, who's satisfied with your work. And a lot of people ignore that. And that's something that I always stress to people is optimize your profile. I have a course on it that tells you how to do the right thing, look for keywords, and it really makes a difference. You can really achieve a lot higher results if you do something like that because people are going to judge you, and if you don't look well on LinkedIn, it's going to not be in your interest to do any outreach unless you get that up to speed.
All right, so you just mentioned something I didn't know about. Tell us about your course.
Well, I have a course on my website where it's about a 10 modules that go through the steps and how to optimize your profile from the headshot to creating a bio that is going to be impactful and also how to use it with AI to generate, you know, the keywords that are going to get you found on LinkedIn, which I think is really crucial. So it goes you through all the details on it. And I have a second one, a course that teaches you how to do outreach and what words to say to people who you're connecting with. And offer value to whoever you're connecting with. For example, when I do an outreach, I offer a free ebook, you know, to help people. And it's really, you know, you want to really just connect with someone and give them value. A lot of times people, when they first connect, they pitch slap them. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term, but nobody likes to be pitch slapped at all. And I find majority-wise they're doing it, and that's a really turnoff. And I'll usually unfriend these people, even block them, because they just really don't make common sense. So you really... Whenever you're connected with someone, don't do anything like that. Just be friendly. If you can offer an ebook, that's great. Or, you know, just keep it under wraps. And most importantly, when they post on LinkedIn, you want to comment on their post. You know, you want to show that you're adding something to the post. Because most of the time when they do post, most people don't even look at it for the most part. It's kind of lonely. So, and do something more than, you know, thanks for sharing and stuff. You know, try to be a little more descriptive in how the post was helpful for them. And that's something will help to create awareness, and they may decide to reach out to you and say, you know, I appreciate your comments on it, and, you know, what else do you do? That's really a good way to connect with someone. Sometimes it's better to be a follower of an influencer and try to do an outreach connect, because most of the time you won't get accepted. And if anything, the more you do that, it may be considered like spam with LinkedIn algorithm. So you want to try to avoid that. Ideally, follow if it's an influencer you want to be with. And if they do post, you can actually be alerted when they do post. So you can respond quickly to that post and provide them with commentary that would be favorable to whatever they're saying. I think is a great way to connect with people.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you for joining us today.
Welcome. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you again.
And now for something completely different. I hope that didn't get us banned on the BBC. Bill, you
yes.
have a new role-playing game that you've been looking at, Call of Cthulhu. Go ahead and tell us about it and give us your thoughts.
Well, it's a new campaign for Call of Cthulhu called Sutra of the Pale Leaves, Twin Suns Rising. It's the first book of two. It contains three scenarios. And the interesting thing is, usually Call of Cthulhu takes place back in like the 1920s or Victorian era. This one is set in 1980s Japan.
Oh.
Okay, that's different.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Which is interesting because Japan has a very big following of Call of Cthulhu. They love their Call of Cthulhu, like we love our D&D.
No, but I think this is the first time I've ever heard of a different situation at all. Is it always been 1920s, or is it that just usually the case?
Just usually the case. I mean, I've had some that are 1950s. It all depends. I mean, they just like that era because of the noir, I think, feeling.
Well, wasn't the original writer's stories set in the 20s, or am I wrong?
Lovecraft was in the 10s and 20s, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so that makes sense. So, tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, like I said, it's set in 1980s Japan, and it is a interesting take on the Yellow King, which is a creature in the mythos of H.P. Lovecraft, in the Cthulhu mythos. And it has him being more of a neutral party than an antagonist or a protagonist role, which is going to be interesting. What you end up with the scenarios here, just a quick rundown. You have Dream Eater, which is a strange dreams of monsters torment the people of Ikaruga. Fanfic, rumors speak of a cursed manga comic book.
Uh-huh.
The Pallid Mask of Tokyo. A murderer is discovered, but the corpse has no face.
Ew.
That's creepy.
Yeah.
Yep, so these can be played as a campaign setting, all three together in order, or individually as you like.
So do you play characters that are supposed to be Japanese?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Okay, so it is a completely different setup. And these modules are like storylines, right?
Yeah, they're like normal campaigns like we used to play. You know, like Descent into Avernus or other things.
Right. Okay, so yeah, no, that's...
So is the environment immersive into Japan? You know, like the cities and the landscape and... Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got a map in here of just the rail line system, you know, that Japan uses. And I'm impressed by how much detail they put into it. But they really threw in a lot of that 1980s feel, the artwork style, just what different things you could find. You know, the internet was coming of age. What role computers and such plays in this campaign, video games, of course, manga, which was a big thing in the 80s and still is. And, again, like I said, the artwork style in here really is reminiscent of that era.
Neat. I wish I could see it.
Well, I imagine it's worth checking out, and you could certainly do that online.
Yeah.
You know, Gretchen, but I know with role-playing games in general, you have some that a lot of care and quality goes into. And Bill, it sounds like you're saying that this is one that's fairly well done like that.
Chaosium does that. I've noticed they really put the time and effort into every product they put in to just give you as best an experience as possible. Like we just covered 2 weeks ago, Age of Vikings. Mm-hmm. Just the amount of detail they went into that to character creation, let alone the setting, you know, they really pull out the stops on that. And I'm always impressed by their company.
I mean, role-playing games when done right are your true open world. We could say that in video games when you can kind of pal around and stuff, but the imagination is really the limit on these things. If it's done well, it really is a lot of fun. And you know, some are better than others. In this case, it sounds great. Now, are you actually playing a campaign with these or Call of Cthulhu right now at all? I know you have in the past.
I'm looking forward to running this one when I have some downtime in my current campaigns. We are very in-depth into what we're at with D&D currently, but I'm looking really forward to these. Like, I usually run them when we have people that are going to be gone for a period of time or something like that, just so we have something to do.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, we kind of do the same thing up here, too, is we have the main one, and then if people are missing or if we just don't feel like it, you have a backup.
Like a side mission, you know.
Side game, yeah.
Yeah.
Side quest. I don't know if that's exactly the right term for it, but it's certainly that kind of an idea. And yeah, so, all right, is this something you just order from Amazon or pick up at your game shop or?
Yeah, or you can pick it up from Chaosium directly. I always suggest ordering directly from them because you also get that and usually you get the PDFs of it.
Yeah, and plus you're supporting the author a little bit more. If you go through a third-party site, and it's just the way it is, and that's how they make money, but they take a little bit more of a piece of it. So I try to do that, especially with artistic things like this, whether it's books or, you know, artwork of some other kind, and get it straight from the person that actually published it when you can.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense. All right, so question that's come in from listeners when you've talked about this in the past, is there a Call of Cthulhu video game?
Yes, there is. I think there was actually a few of them.
Really?
Have you played any of them? I didn't know this until...
I've played one based on a Call of Cthulhu myth idea. Came out really good. It was a story-driven one. I know there's... Oh, what was it? The Sinking City or something, I believe, was a video game that came out 3-4 years ago. It was based on Call of Cthulhu.
That sounds familiar.
A great number of them.
Have we played the game Sinking City, where it's like it's getting lower and the water's rising and you have to figure something out before a certain time, otherwise everything goes under?
Yeah, you're playing a video. That's what he is, the main character is doing, is trying to figure out different things. Now it's a little bit more pulp than I believe most Call of Cthulhu, because there was a lot of enemies and shooting and stuff that not necessarily happens in the Cthulhu Mythos, which is usually just you against the universe of, you know,
right, right.
But
that totally makes sense. No, I hadn't even really thought about that until someone asked the question. And you know, it's worth checking some of these out too, especially if this is a genre that you're into. And a quick search on the internet, I actually see, looks like 5 games that are based on Call of Cthulhu. The Sinking City being the one that you just talked about. Dark Corners of the Earth, Bloodborne, Dredge, to name a few of the other ones. And it totally makes sense that would be the case. And if anybody's listening that has played these, let us know what you think of them, because sometimes video game ports of role-playing games can be great, and other times, not so much. We've seen a lot of games based, as a for example, on Dungeons & Dragons over the years. And this is something that goes back to, well, retro computers. I think there's actually a Dungeons & Dragons game on the Intellivision. There might even be on the first Ataris.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are very good, and some of them are just like, what is going on here, you know?
Yeah.
So... Definitely, absolutely, definitely worth checking out. And one of the things, too, that's kind of cool in this time is you can actually look at playthroughs and different stuff like that. And even on the role-playing game front, it's kind of interesting to check it out and see, you know, what others do and get some ideas. And I think I might have even mentioned this a few weeks ago on the show, but we're playtesting Shadowrun. And ended up, I didn't know much about the character generation, so I asked ChatGPT to generate a character for me. And in about 10 seconds, had the character sheet and everything the way I wanted it. I made a few changes on it. But yeah, some things like that have certainly changed over the years. But the face of it, not so much. It's still, you know, about imagination, usually, more or less. So
how did that playthrough go?
We haven't had it yet. We were supposed to do it last Friday. I had a personal emergency last week, so we had to put it off. And I think we're going to be doing it this coming Friday, if everything goes well. So I will certainly talk about it here when I know.
You'll have to tell me how initiative is. I've heard it can be quite a complicated subject.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm just creating the characters. Because mine was done in 30 seconds. Everybody else took 2 or 3 hours. So, you know, but.
Really?
I'm sure they figured. Yeah, I'm sure they figured out how I did it. Yeah. But
it's an in-depth character creation.
Yeah. Wow. And that's not the longest one. There are some systems where it could take 6-8 hours. I think I want to say Elf Quest or something was one like that that I did a long time ago. And the session zero was like a whole day.
Yeah, Dread is like that, where it's based on Judge Dread, where you create a character, and your character can die in character creation, so it's
that's nice. Problem.
But you basically have a session just for character creation, and if your character survives, you get the character to the end, but it can take 6 hours.
Yeah.
And I know with Triton Gaming System, that one took me quite a while to figure out, because as they said, they don't handhold for anybody. So that one took me a while to get a character made.
Yeah, and some of these, it's not easy either, because some of it is intuitive, and then you have some of these other systems where there's charts and graphs, and I think more information than you need to become a pilot. You have to figure out to get it done properly, and then if you don't do something right, the character doesn't work out, and you're missing some, you know, characteristic or something you need for the game, and then you get to do it all over again. Or in my case, nice to our game masters and just allow them to let me respawn with the appropriate changes. Oh man. Yeah, that is kind of a bummer. I used to have that happen. What was it, Gretchen? We used to play with some friends. It was a D&D-esque card game. And I would always die, it seemed like, right in the beginning of it. I can't even remember the name of that anymore.
I wasn't part of that. I don't remember that.
This would have been 15 years ago, and you and Jeremy were there, but...
We were?
I'm not surprised that you don't remember. It was not that memorable.
Was it that bad?
I don't know if I would go that far, but it definitely was not, let's just say, not as much fun as the actual role-playing game. And being that it was as complicated, it's like, why wouldn't you just do the regular game, you know?
Yeah.
I went to a Pathfinder, put out a card game, and that one was really interesting because it played like D&D or Pathfinder.
Right.
But you were using the cards instead of worrying about character sheets.
Hmm.
So you had a character card, and then you had a weapon card, and your magic card.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems like, I want to say it was like Dungeon Mayhem or something.
I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, or something along those lines. If not, it's pretty close. And I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that love this, and I think that's great. I'm not dissing it. I'm just saying it wasn't quite my thing. But, But I'm not really into card games that much. I did Magic the Gathering at one time, and, some of those, the Pikachu one.
Pokemon.
If it's something you have to like what you're doing, and I am not saying these are bad, I think they're well done. But like even Pokemon Pikachu, you know, that kind of a thing. I was more into the augmented reality stuff with that, where you could actually buy a watch and it would tell you where the monster is when you were walking around so that you could catch it. Now, to me, that was cool. The game, but that part of it was really, really cool, you know? So. All right, well, that's it for this week. Until next week, this is User-Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User-Friendly 2.0, copyright 2013 to 2025 by User-Friendly Media Group, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Content is the opinion of the show's participants and not necessarily this station or platform. Requests for material use, interviews, CCPA, Privacy Notice for California residents, GDPR information for UK and EU residents, and any other feedback may be submitted at userfriendly.show. We welcome your input. Thank you for listening.